Hi, and welcome to the world of rock. Justin Hayward, John Lodge, the two of the Jays. Not blue, but the weather is sort of blue today. Blue Jays, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, yeah.
I remember that Blue Jays. I remember Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yeah.
It was the first time in history that Carnegie Hall was sold out, packed. I mean, the admission was right.
Yeah.
To listen to an album, not a concert.
No, to watch a record.
To watch and listen to a record.
But it was the only place you could hear the record, you know, like about a week up front of the record coming out. Yeah. But it was unbelievable. I remember John and I saying at the time, we should take this on tour, because we were sitting in the dressing room saying, how are we going down, you know? All we had to do was stay in the dressing room and come out at the end. And
the amazing thing was, after sort of each track was the applause, and at the end of the show, at the end of the album, you know, everybody getting up and applauding. And it was just this record. Well, it was a tape actually going round and round. But it was quite bizarre.
It was a great event.
The Moody Blues, a brand spanking new album. That's always a historic occasion. And, let's start first with a title, because it is something different in title. And you guys always like to do something different, artwork and also. Tell us about it. La Mer.
Okay, well, there's a lot of water and sea references during the on the album, in the lyrics of the album, and we were at a sleeve meeting, and we were particularly interested in pictures, contemporary artists of the 1950s, and we were going through a book of really lovely paintings from that period, and we found this painting by Nicolas de Staël of the fort at Antibes in the south of France, and we said, that's it, that's the image that we want on the front of the album. It represents what we were trying to say with the kind of mood of the album. So the painting wasn't called Sur la Mer, but that's we came up with that title.
Well, you know, I think people who are Moody Blues fans kind of look forward to the cover and art and something different,
sure.
And you've always done that. So, okay, but inside we got some real tasty music. The single was in advance, of course, and I guess listening to some of the other songs, you've done a lot of variety, again, in this album, and collectively is all the group together, and everyone liked the material, and you obviously left some things out, you have a reason.
Sure.
Was it Collective Minds that released the single, I Know You're Out There, somewhere?
Yeah, we felt that from the moment that we recorded it that it was the right single and the right sort of vanguard for the album. It set a standard. It was actually one of the first tracks. We did two tracks last summer, in between touring here in the USA last summer. That was one of them, and it really set the standard for the rest of the album. And we're very pleased that the record company chose it as the first single.
You're producing help, and yep. You frequently have some people involved. I want to talk about Tony in this particular case.
Yeah. Well, our producer is Tony Visconti, who is a great friend of myself and John's, and is a musician and an engineer, and he's really relieved us of that thing where you have a producer who has to talk to the engineer to get the sound and then sort of relay it back to you. Tony is an engineer himself, so he's got his finger right on the button all the time, and he's a great musician. We've learned a lot together, the three of us, about the technology of recording, about programming, and about new keyboard instruments. You know, we've all become much better keyboard players through the last couple of albums, and it's been an exciting time recording for us. We've state-of-the-art recording, solid-state logic desks, and digital mixing and mastering. It's been great.
We also, as with the cover of the album, the colours of the album cover are really important, and it's the same in the recording technique, that to have someone behind the desk who you can talk colours, this is the sound we want, this is the colour of the sound. Let's not get into the technicalities of what cycles we're talking about, or what dB, or what roll-off, roll-on, whatever. We're talking about colours, and Tony's great at that. Because, you know, as Justin was saying, he is a musician and an engineer at the same time, as well as a producer. So we could talk of the vision that we wanted on each different track. And that way you can get a much more three-dimensional picture of each song.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of personal experience that went into it, and it is a searching, seeking song, like a lot of the Moody Blues songs are. But it strikes a particular chord for us in the band and me, and I know a lot of people are going to share that feeling with us. Here it is. I know you're out there somewhere.
There are 10 songs in all in the new album from the Moody Blues, Sur la Mer. Were they chosen out of a number of songs, or for different reasons? Did you purposely try to get different things? Let's talk about some of the songs that you like personally. I mean, you like all of them, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
They're Moody Blues songs, but is there a story involved with any one of them that's kind of strange, or the way you came to write?
I think, as I was saying just at the beginning, that we started off with Les May actually recording, and I Know You're Out There Somewhere was one of the first tracks. And that sort of set us off down the Moody Blues road. Mm-hmm. And then it was just excitement from there on in. It really is. And, you know, the picture builds up, the album builds up. And the album is actually the longest album we've ever recorded. I think it's 52 minutes long. And we think it's a whole picture, it's a whole journey, and hopefully a totally emotional experience for everyone listening to the album.
52 minutes, let's see, let me think of Days of Future Past. I guess not 52 minutes,
no,
a lot of long cuts. But
it was about 45 minutes, I think, Days of Future Past. Yeah.
Beautiful long cuts, yeah. But...
I like the second track on the album, which is called Want to Be With You. You know, I think it's one that we co-wrote, and we've been doing a lot more of that the last two albums. We started doing that 3 albums ago, and it's really worked out well. And Want to Be With You, I think, is the best thing that we've written together, and it means a lot to us. I know, you know, if you've ever seen two guys writing a song with lumps in their throats and a little tear in their eye, yeah. But it was a very emotional song, and very, strangely enough, very easy to record. We prepared a lot of the stuff before we went into the studio, so we knew exactly the feeling that and mood that we wanted to capture. It was very important to us, and we were able to faithfully reproduce our original ideas, you know, in the studio. And it's very rare that you can really bring down that essence and portray it clearly in a song.
Moody Blues people are a family, and that's just the way it should be because of the tradition of the music. The album forms that you've given us through the years, and we're all extremely happy that the Moody Blues exist after this number of years. And we would also like to know, are we going to get to see you in tour around America?
Sure.
Yeah, one of the reasons we're here in New York, of course, right now, is that we just sealed up the tour, and we start July 27, and we're going to go all across America until... The first part of the tour is going to go until September 10, and then we're coming back in October. And so if we've not been to your city, we'll be back by then.
And the second part of the tour will probably go till around Christmas time?
I think so, through October, November anyway, yeah.
We'd like actually to... one of the things we've never done is been in New York at around Christmas time, or America actually. And it'd be really nice to be able to do some concerts around about that time. It'd be a great experience for us. I'm sure it'd be fabulous for everyone.
So that the tour is going to be extensive enough that a lot of our people in all the cities across America are going to get a chance this time to see the Moody Blues.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
We've just agreed, I think, 70 shows across America this year.
The album, the recording of the album, was it all done in one location this time? Did you go back home to an old studio?
Yeah, you've been there. We recorded in Soho, right in the middle of London. Actually, it's like returning to our roots. A lot of the first ever recordings we did as young musicians were done in Denmark Street, and there's an area around the centre of the West End of London called Soho, and right in that area is Denmark Street and Charing Cross Road, where a lot of the young musicians go and get jobs in bands and all that kind of stuff. But there's always been excellent studios around there. So we returned to that area to make this album, and we kept to a very strict recording timetable, and it was very good, very disciplined, and we did a lot of preparation up front. And it's exciting coming back into town. as opposed to sort of going out into the country and spending 3 years making an album and, you know, it's a very long sort of slow process. This was much more immediate and much more satisfying.
I think at the very beginning when you record, as with Days of Future Past, very beginning of all recordings, you're very disciplined by the record company because they say you've got 3 sessions booked this week from 10 till 3, 6 till 7 or whatever the times. And as you become, you know, more successful, you start to wander off down that road of mega bookings, you know, 3 months in the studio at a time, and you probably do 3 hours a day. And so it's quite difficult to actually sit down and say, let's really discipline ourselves. And we actually record it from 11 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock of a night every day. And it was a great self-discipline to say that's exactly... And so you prepare yourself mentally. You know, some people can say, well, how can you create, you know, to such rigid rules? But you do. You actually say, mentally, I'm ready to do this today. And it works.
The Moody Blues sound, as the last 3 or 4 years, the number of records that we call crossover that really went all over everywhere, was this accidental, or did you guys collectively decide, okay, we have these songs, we think they're good songs, and if we maintain our sound and our integrity, that we can do something? I mean, a perfect example is, I know you're out there somewhere, because it is obviously, without a doubt, a Moody Blues song. It doesn't need to be given, its title doesn't even have to be given. Here is a new Moody Blues song. Did you guys work on this theory? I mean, because the last two albums have 2 and 3 singles that went everywhere, mm-hmm. into other forms of radio. And
yeah, no, we didn't. I can't see us working on that. We have a particular sound, for better or worse, you know, and I don't really think we've ever done anything by design. The only thing that we've always said is that we must stick to our guns, we must trust our own judgment and make music that we want to hear. And as long as we stick by that, then, you know, we can share it with a number of other people. We've been through our periods where, you know, we haven't sold so many albums, and we've had albums that just haven't done as well as the rest, you know. But in those times, we've been able to go out on tour. The most important thing for us is to share the music with as many people as possible. And in the absence of, say, a record company spending zillions and zillions of dollars creating Moody Mania Week, you know, it's been down to the disc jockeys and radio stations across America that have helped us right from the beginning and have spread the word.
When Justin Hayward and John Lodge are not in the studio and not on tour, and the creative minds start to wander, are there some new people that you have seen in concert or that you listen to, maybe... and say, well, it's interesting, because certainly compared to the late 60s and early 70s, there aren't as many people involved, but there's some differences out there. Do you like to get out and sneak, not let anybody know, and you sneak in some little club somewhere and catch groups? Do you do that?
Sure, now and again, yeah. And particularly in Great Britain, you're bombarded with what's happening that particular week. And it's almost, in Britain, it's almost like fashion has taken over from music. The fashion comes first and the music is second, you know? And things, because things come and go so quickly within a couple of weeks. But I don't know, whatever's in the charts, say, there's always some merit in it. Whatever people say about, oh, I hate that bloody record that's at number 3 or something, I can always see why it's there, and I can always, because there isn't a record that ever gets into the top 20 that's not good in its own way, you know, and it has some merit in its own right.
The other interesting thing, of course, is the CD. CD's been available now, and it means a lot of obscure records that perhaps we'd heard about people, like Zydeco music, Cajun music. You know, you can get all this now on CD, and records which had sort of been deleted. You can just wander through record shops now and say, oh, this is great.
It's interesting that you're mentioning the British charts, because each week, one of the things we do on this show in the world of rock is we do spotlight the music that is selling. Mm-hmm. And there can't be anything more diversified from week to week than that list. It might even be a soccer team, but I mean, that's expected. But
that's
incredible changes from, and recently there's been a huge wave of, I guess, conveniently, is disco and rap.
Rap, yeah, right. And hip-hop stuff, yeah.
Hip-hop is sampling exactly what they're called. Yeah, music. And then in between, there's always something else, too. And and then there's a Rick Astley comes along, and he's the new teen idol, and then there's something else, but it never stops moving. It just changes. And
sure. Yeah. The only disturbing part about it is that, like, where we were recording this album, in the middle of London, a lot of these kids come by the studio and you see a lot of young musicians, and because you're right in the center of it there. And the only disturbing thing about the way the English charts go is that some of these kids that have a big hit record, 18, 19 years old, a year later, forget it. It's all over for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's very worrying. Somebody said to me the other day, whatever happened to Hazy Fantasy? Now, this is a group like 2 years ago who were the biggest thing, and like last year it was Curiosity Killed the Cat, you know? You can't get arrested now. It's disturbing.
Very fickle.
Yeah.
This year it's Fairground Attraction, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's going to be the band for this year.
Well, that's very number one right now. Yes. Currently.
Yeah. Great guitar solo in that record.
It's kind of a funky record. It's certainly not a disco or rap. It sounds like something from the late 40s.
I love that empty sort of sound. It's great.
It's kind of surprising when you get a record amidst all the other things and see that people turn around and buy that as well as the other things. How about, do you remember anything? We were just reminiscing a little. Do you remember anything that... doesn't make any difference how long ago of a group that you thought really should have made it, or an individual, and somehow just sort of didn't happen, and maybe don't know why, or there's no real reason. Maybe it was bad timing. Maybe it was promotion efforts or something. Anything come to mind? You know, we were just as long as we're talking about it. I mean, I kind of felt a few years ago, Ultravox, the group that Midgeur started, should have been bigger than they were. They had something just different, and they had a different approach. And I think there was troubles within the group and all. Midge, of course, has survived and is an accomplished musician, but, you know, that would be sort of an example. Did you like Ultravox when they
started?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're good music.
Yeah, I think they all splintered off, and I think they've all done so well individually, I think, as well. You know, there was a whole different mood of music then when Midge came along with that Ultravox, you know, the Alison Moye, and there was a whole different mood, and it didn't last very long, really, but it was great.
Does Alison still do well in her personal appearances? She has a lot.
Sure.
She's probably going to be a survivor.
Yeah. Oh, I think so, yeah, because she's got such a great voice, and that can never be denied, you know.
Yeah, the Love Letters thing that she did, the old song, that had been sort of a blues. Yeah. And she did a really nice job on it.
Really well.
Play both. And
I wonder what happened to Lorraine Ellison. Do you remember Stay With Me, Baby? What a record that was. Yeah. Wow. How could
Mark
you follow
down
that?
Whatever happened to Lorraine Ellison, that's right. Stay With Me, Baby. Mm.
Well, we got carried away on the new album sleeve. There's
I have no idea what it is, because all I have
really
is this.
It's beautiful. There's a magazine called Hit Magazine, which somebody showed me yesterday, and they've got the artwork in beautiful colour in the magazine. It's superb. I mean, whether it's a great magazine, I don't know, but the artwork's in there. But on the left-hand side, there's a little red dot when you see the artwork. But we went through a lot of trouble to me talking about how bright that red dot should be, you know, because it's really important not to, you know, be too bright for the painter, but it had to be a statement. And it does look fabulous on the must own.
You mentioned you can go home again sort of by going back to the original location and original studios when Moody Blues began their careers and their recording sessions, and how great it was and how you felt really good about that. Mm-hmm. In those memories, why don't we think of a cut or story or something from one of the early days and maybe lead into some classic Moody Blues. Want to try that, John or Justin?
Okay, well, I remember that probably the best and most exciting time for us was just after Days of Future Past, because with our first album, Days of Future Past, we discovered a direction, finally. We discovered the music that was right for us to write and to play, so we discovered our own identity, and it's like discovering some kind of truth within yourself, you know, and a revelation about your own personality and your own being, really, what kind of person you are. So the album that we made after that was called In Search of the Lost Chord. And I know that album means a lot to people. If people remember that album, it had the yantra thing inside, and we were very much into transcendental meditation and stuff at that kind of time. And it was a very beautiful and exciting time for us as young men going through a lot of experiences together. And I think we created a lot of things on that album that had a strange kind of empty sort of beauty about them. And it was almost as if there was... Sometimes you get the feeling when you're recording that there's someone by your side, you know, that there's something more than just the five of you there. And the combination of the five of you is certainly more than greater than the sum of the parts or whatever. And there's a track that I particularly love from that album, which embodies so many things that we believed in and we were experiencing then, and it was called The Actor.
From day one of our recording, we used to record in the centre of London, but when we did Days of Future Past, it was a studio called... it was the Decca Studios in West Hampstead, and it was an old town hall where they used to have sort of ballroom dancing in the 30s, I think. And they had a stage, and below the stage was the old dance floor, which became the studio. But we used to set up on the stage itself, which was all carpeted. But we had a little table with brown carpet on, this little table. And that table has heard every conversation that the Moody's took part in for like 14 years, because that table went with us everywhere and was still with us, I think, on the Long Distance Voyager album. This table, and it got grubbier and grubbier and burnt. It was never, ever cleaned, because there was something magic, I think, that this table had, because it knew everything that we had ever talked about, ever discussed, and it was... I'm sure it's got all the stories there. You know, if it had been a tape recorder or a microchip, it could actually give you the complete history of the Moody Blues, this table. And I think I'd like to do Singer in a Rock and Roll Band, because what it did for me was to say, whatever the mysticism, whatever people said you were or whatever you weren't, what we are and what we all are are singers in a rock and roll band. An interesting album story was just before America landed on the moon, we went into the studio and we were discussing what theme we should do for the album. And we thought it'd be fantastic to think of a rocket journey going out there and what it'd be like for that person, not as a spaceman, but as a person flying out there. If any one of us in the band could have actually flown out there, what would we think looking back at Earth? Not looking at the moon, but looking back at Earth. And we thought, that's the album we want to do. We want to do this album to our children's children's children, because it's something going out, looking back. And for the beginning of the album, we wanted the sound of a rocket going off, because we thought it'd be great in stereo, everybody got the cans on or whatever, listening to this rocket going off, it's going to blow everybody's brains out. So we got in touch with NASA and said, send us all your rocket takings off. And they were all like damp fizzes. They were damp squids. They were terrible. So we sat about in the studio for about a week making what I think is one of the greatest rocket sounds. And when you hear the takeoff on Children's Children, I think you've got to agree for that year that it was done and the equipment available, that does sound like a rocket.
Well, I know that about a year or so ago, or a couple of years ago, I decided to get a lot more truth in my own life and to try and realise myself and what I am and what I want out of life a lot a lot more, really. And so it's a perfect subject for a song, because so many relationships you have with people, you become another person specifically for that person, because you know that that's an easy way to sort of mold yourself to what that person wants you to be and to keep it all nice and comfortable. You sort of switch onto the, oh, I'm the Scott Mooney now for so-and-so, you know, and then I'm the Justin Hayward for somebody else. And you have so many different personalities. I think it's refreshing and nice when you can just be yourself all the time, be truthful around your life. And so I really decided to write a song about that. And I was surprised how simply and how quickly it turned out in the studio. It was a very, very basic song. And it was one of those songs we tried so hard to overdub an awful lot of things onto, which just didn't work, you know. The truthful thing about the whole song was it didn't need anything doing to it, you know. It was so simple, it almost evaded us. And we ended up with, you know, John on bass, drums, myself doing keyboards, Patrick doing a keyboard part, me doing some acoustic guitars and an electric guitar riff, and that's it. You know, keep it as simple as that. And it's, a lot of people have started to talk about that song, and it's very rewarding, because there's certain songs that you think when you make an album, oh, it's just a filler, it's just an album track, you know, nobody... People will probably just pass over that and they'll think, oh, very nice and everything. But it struck a chord with a lot of people. And maybe that's the truth that people are looking for in their own lives, too.
When the Moody Blues perform live, and the Moody Blues in the studio, wonderful, gorgeous, magnificent sounds and all. When you now are on the stage to perform live for people, you really are the same people. And it is your family of fans and friends that turn you on.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Absolutely,
yeah. The object of the exercise for us is to share it with as many people as we can, to share our music and make people aware of it.
It's the energy that comes from, you know, a lot of people say, you know, what is it like to be on stage? It's not just being on stage. It's the energy that the people out there are giving you, because you're all there for one reason, really, to have a great time, to enjoy the music, and the players and the listeners. And the most important thing is if the energy's going both ways, then you've got excitement. I think this is what the album's about, Sur la Mer. We recorded the album after we've been doing extensive touring around the world, and last year we were in Canada, Alaska, Hawaii, Australia, USA, then went straight into the studio. And our albums have always been a searching process. We were always looking for something. And we actually came right down to earth by saying, yeah, but there is a search that we all do during that summer period where college is out, school's out, work's out, whatever it is. And it's something happens magic during the summer for everyone. And it's the apprehension that something magic is going to happen. And I think that's what the album is about, the Sur la Mer. It was the energy of the audience from all those years of touring that has come and made the album for us.
Justin Hayward, John Lodge, you two, back up a ways. Where did you meet?
We met at a house in Esher in Surrey, southwest of London. I'd met Mike first. John knew Ray from working with Ray in the band from Birmingham from years before that. So we walked into a front room of a house in Esher, never met before, and just literally played together, played some songs together. And it was great, you know. It was a combination, the Moody's combination of five very different personalities. So you're talking about the beginning of 1966, 22 years ago.
And it happened straight away. Bang.